Chapter 11. Isaac Bell whisked his over-under two-shot Derringer out of his hat in a blur of motion and fired at the third gangster, who was lunging at Alistair MacDonald's back with a knife. The range was close, nearly point-blank. The heavy 44 slug stopped him in his tracks, and the blade fell from his hand. But even as the roar of gunfire sent patrons stampeding for cover, the dandy with the bloody nose was thrusting another knife at the Scotsman's belly. MacDonald gaped, as if astonished that a friendly brawl would turn deadly. Isaac Bell realized that he was witnessing a premeditated attempt at murder. A fleeing spectator blocked his vision. Bell slammed him out of his way and fired again. Above MacDonald's bloody nose, the knife wielder grew a red hole between the eyes. His knife fell inches short of Alistair MacDonald's belt. Bell's Derringer was empty. The remaining killer, the one floored, rose behind MacDonald with a fluid ease that showed him neither hurt nor slowed by the blow he had taken to his ear. A long-bladed knife flipped open in his hand. Bell was already pulling his Browning No. 2 semi-automatic from under his coat. The killer thrust his knife at MacDonald's back. Tucking the pistol to his body to shield it from the running men, Bell fired. He knew that he would have stopped the killer dead with a shot to the brain. But someone crashed into him just as he pulled the trigger. He did not miss by much. The shot pierced the dandy's right shoulder. But the Browning's pinpoint accuracy was gained at the cost of stopping power, and the killer was left-handed. Although the .380 caliber slug staggered him, momentum was on the killer's side, and he managed to sink his blade into Alistair MacDonald's broad back. MacDonald still looked astonished. His eyes met Bell's even as the detective caught him in his arms. "They tried to kill me," he marveled. Bell eased the suddenly dead weight to the sawdust and knelt over him. "Get a doctor," Bell shouted. "Get an ambulance."
"Laddie."
"Don't talk," said Bell. Blood was spreading rapidly, so fast that the sawdust floated on it instead of absorbing it.
"Give me your hand, Isaac."
Bell took the huge splayed hand in his.
"Please, give me your hand."
"I've got you, Alistair."
"Get a doctor!"
Angelo Del Rossi knelt beside them.
"Doc's coming. He's a good one. You'll be okay, Professor. Won't he, Bell?"
"Of course," Bell lied. MacDonald gripped Bell's hand convulsively and whispered something Bell could not hear. He leaned closer.
"What did you say, Alistair?" "Listen."
"I can't hear you." But the big Scotsman said nothing. Bell whispered into his ear,
"They came after you, Alistair. Why?"
MacDonald opened his eyes. They grew wide with sudden recognition, and he whispered,
"Hull 44.
"What?" MacDonald closed his eyes, as if falling asleep. "I'm a doctor. Get out of my way." Bell moved aside. The doctor, youthful, brisk, and apparently competent, counted MacDonald's pulse. Heartbeat like a station clock. "I have an ambulance on the way. Some of you men help me carry him." "I'll do it," said Bell. "He weighs 200 pounds. "Get out of my way." Isaac Bell cradled the fallen boxer in his arms, stood to his feet, and carried MacDonald out the door to the sidewalk, where Bell held him while they waited for the ambulance. Camden cops were holding back the crowds. A police detective demanded Bell's name. "Isaac Bell, Van Dorn operative."
"Nice shooting in there, Mr. Bell.
Did you recognize the dead men?"
"Never saw them before."
"Out of town? Philadelphia?"
"They had New York train tickets in their pockets."
"Care to tell me how you got mixed up in this?"
"I'll tell you everything I can, which isn't much, as soon as I get this fellow to the hospital."
"I'll be waiting for you at headquarters. Tell the desk sergeant you want to see Barney George."
A motor ambulance mounted on the new Model T chassis pulled up in front of the dance hall. As Bell laid MacDonald inside, the boxer clutched his hand again. Bell climbed in with him beside the doctor and rode to the hospital. While a surgeon worked on the Scot in the operating room, Bell telephoned New York with orders to warn John Skelly, who was watching hull designer Farley Kent, and to dispatch operatives to the naval torpedo station at Newport to guard the life of Ron Wheeler. Three men central to the American dreadnought program had died, and a fourth was at death's door. But if he had not witnessed the attack on Alistair MacDonald, it would have been reported as a likely event in a saloon brawler's life instead of attempted murder. There was already a possibility that Langner had been murdered. What if the Bethlehem Foundry explosion MacDonald had told them about wasn't an accident? Was the Westchester climbing accident murder, too? Bell sat by the man's bed all night and into the morning. Suddenly, at noon, Alistair MacDonald filled his mighty chest with a shuddering breath and let it slowly sigh away. Bell shouted for the doctor, but he knew it was hopeless. Saddened and deeply angry, Bell went to the Camden police headquarters and reported to Detective George his part in failing to stop the attack. "Did you retrieve any of their knives?" Bell asked when he had finished. "All three." George showed them to Bell. Alistair MacDonald's blood had dried on the blade that killed him. "Strange-looking things, aren't they?" Bell picked one of the two others not stained and examined it. "It's a butterfly, messer."
"A who?"
"A German folding knife, modeled on a Balisong butterfly knife. Quite rare outside the Philippine Islands."
"I'll say. I've never seen one."
"German, you say?" Bell showed him the maker's mark incised on the tang of the blade. "Bontgen and Sabin of Solingen. Question is, where did they get them?" He looked at the Camden detective full in the face. "How much money did you find in the dead men's pockets?" Detective George looked aside. Then he made a show of flipping through the pages of his handwritten case notes. "Oh, yeah, here it is. Less than $10 each." Eyes cold, voice grim, Bell said, "I am not interested in recouping what might have gone astray before it was recorded as evidence. But the correct number, the actual amount of cash in their pockets, will indicate whether they were paid to do the killing. That amount, spoken privately between you and me, will be an important clue for my investigation." The Camden cop pretended to read his notes again. "Kelly had $8.02. Butler had $7, a dime, and a nickel." Isaac Bell's bleak gaze dropped to the butterfly messer he was holding. With a peculiar flick of his wrist, he caused the blade to fly open. It glinted like ice. He appeared to study it, as if wondering what use to put it to. Detective George, though deep in the confines of his own precinct, nervously wet his lips. Bell said, "A working man earns about $500 a year. A year's pay to kill a man might seem the right amount to an evil person who would commit such an act for money. Therefore, it would help me to know whether those two killers who did not escape were carrying such a large sum." Detective George breathed a sigh of relief. "I guarantee you, neither packed such a roll." Bell stared at him. Detective George looked happy he had not lied. Finally, Bell asked, "Mind if I keep one of these knives?"
"I'll have to ask you to sign for it, but not the one they killed him with. We'll need that for the trial if we ever catch the son of a bitch, which ain't likely if he don't come back to Camden."
"He's coming back," Isaac Bell vowed. "In chains."